So good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us this morning. This is, I think, the fourth installment on our J-POW Summer Institute series on different facets of what we're seeking to explore as both global and local issues that present themselves within the context of justice, power, oppression, and women. This morning, we'll be focusing on education as our topic, and we have a panel of amazing individuals who we'll introduce in a bit that will be talking with us. This morning, we thought that we would have a bit of a different format in terms of more of a panel discussion involving everybody, so more of a Q&A. I'll be moderating the flow of the conversation, so we give everybody a chance to be heard and ask questions and hear from our assembled panelists here. I'd like to invite Randy Ross to open us in a brief reflection and some prayer, and then we'll get started. Thanks.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. I'm sad that this is the first J-POW that I've attended, and I confess and I repent and whatever. I've had some other commitments, unfortunately, so I was very delighted to be invited, but I wanted to be here anyway. And so here I am, and about education, I have a call in my life, and I was just mentioning to Clark that just about a week and a half ago, I visited with Mark Rizkala from First Press, who is a math teacher in McClyman's High School, tough part of town. But he has a call. He was featured in the recent First Press Times. He's there on purpose in the context of a school that has experienced a very high turnover of principals and teachers. And, you know, his call is certainly one to build the minds, the intellects, the actual sort of the teaching part of what school is about, but he realizes that building relationships of trust and having staying power in the midst of lots of flux, lots of changes, and lots of instability is so powerful. And he needs all the help he can get. And he said, listen to this, that it's a relatively small school in West Oakland. 70 students began the senior year, 70 seniors. And in June, 37 graduated. The rest went off to the four winds. And the majority in remedial math and reading. And there's all kinds of opportunities for folks to come around that school and come around Mark. And so to me, it's very concrete. This is one person who's called from this church to serve a very needy school in Oakland. And there's lots of needs, and we're going to hear about many contexts around education here today and what's being done. And let's pray, okay? Lord, we, first of all, the best we can do is respond. We know that worship is a response to the God who comes to us with mercy and with grace. And I pray, therefore, Lord, that we will respond to your voice, to your heart, as expressed through our panel and others here this morning, and that the result would be that we would be obedient with joy, that there'd be more salt and light in our world, and that the fragrance of Christ would be spread in the East Bay and beyond. In the name of Jesus we pray. Amen.
Hi, I'm Heather Crandall, and my role today is just to talk a little bit about education in more of a global context and talk a little bit about why we've chosen today to actually focus on the local context. And when I was writing a devotional for the J-POW devotional series, one of the things that I just kept thinking about was how overwhelmed I am by this topic and how just how big it is and how important it is and how much hope there is also within this topic. Even as we hear staggering and heartbreaking statistics, there's also just so much potential for change and for hope in this area. And so I just wanted to share a couple statistics just worldwide that really stand out to me. And what I think is so powerful about education is that it's so far-reaching and it affects so many other issues. For example, education can help to reduce child marriage. In the last 30 seconds, 13 girls under 18 were married, and childbirth is actually the number one cause of death for girls ages 15 to 19, which is just a staggering statistic. But girls who have 8 years of education are 4 times less likely to be married as children. So education can play a role in reducing child marriage. Education plays a role in reducing infant mortality, and it plays a huge role in just health, public health in general. A child born to a literate mother is 50% more likely to survive past the age of 5. So simply having a literate mother can actually greatly extend a child's life expectancy. Amazing to think about. Education has a continuing effect through generations. An educated mother is more than twice as likely to send her children to school. And that effect can just continue and continue and continue and grow. It has a huge economic impact as well. A girl with 1 extra year of education can earn 20% more as an adult. And women actually operate the vast majority of farms and small businesses in the developing world. And so this is just a huge, powerful group of women who can enact so much change, and education can play a tremendous role in that. There are 600 million girls in the developing world. So again, this huge group of people who can make this amazing positive impact on the world. But globally, 42% of girls are not in school. And so this is what breaks our hearts, and this is why, you know, we as a church are really praying about how we can come alongside organizations and schools and be part of this issue. When we watched Girl Rising and when we watched Half the Sky, we had a chance to learn some stories of girls and women in the developing world, which were very powerful. It's sometimes, I think, easy to forget that we have very, very powerful stories right in our own neighborhoods and in our own backyards. And we want to learn about those stories. And so that's why we're here today and have really chosen to focus on education as a local issue and to learn from the perspectives of these amazing folks who are here today. So that's just a little bit of context for today.
Thank you, Heather. That's a lot of statistics in a real short amount of time. And you know, it's important while we frame this issue being on the topic of girls and women. Girls and women are not alone in the world. They have men, and all of us have a role in considering these issues and coming together to address these issues. Let me introduce some people to you from your right to left. So Melissa Philbin has spent the last 5 years as a special ed and reading intervention teacher at Lavagna DeGene Middle School in Richmond. That's the only middle school in Richmond that's a public school there. She's very connected to that community. She lives just a 5-minute walk away from her school. She's also spent time launching an after-school club through Young Life and has great participation there already, which is very exciting. Next to Melissa is Shanita Talton. Did I get that right? And she's a 23-year-old Oakland native. She's the oldest of 5 siblings. And she's been left to, part of her growing up was she was left to manage household duties and manage her siblings while her mother and stepfather were off in their own world of drugs and alcoholism and bipolar disorder. Shanita is a recent Cal grad. Congratulations. And with a degree in social welfare, and is very shortly off to assume a new job in New York City. Next to Shanita is Rick Gaston. Rick has served in education for 24 years as a high school math teacher, first in New Jersey and then moving out here to the Bay Area, where since then he had spent time as an assistant principal and principal at Oakland's Castlemont High School and the Oakland Envision Academy of the Arts and Technology, which is right downtown Oakland. In conversation, Rick says to me, my paraphrase is, being an educator is a 24/7 job. You never rest from that. Rick currently works at KCP Technologies developing math educational software for middle school and high school students. And closest to me is Ashanti Branch, who's the founder and executive director of the Ever Forward Club, which is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization serving students to help them achieve their potential, both young men and young women. 100% of the members of his graduating, the members of the club are high school graduates, and 93% of whom also go on to attend 2- and 4-year college institutions. He teaches math at Oakland's Fremont High School and Arise High School, and has also taken on the role of counselor in the ASAP program. And ASAP is an acronym that stands for Academic Excellence, Social Responsibility, Accountability, and Proactiveness. Ashanti is also an Oakland native. So welcome to you all, and thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm going to get the ball rolling with a couple of questions, and we've got a couple of these microphones that we can have you folks use to answer the questions. And but to get started, perhaps each of you could spend just a couple minutes offering your personal perspective on why you think this is an important issue for you and why you're in education and why you care about this. Just a couple quick minutes, and then we'll move on to some more directed questions.
I see Shanita deferring to me here. By the way, I'm very proud of Shanita here today. She was a student of mine at Castlemont, where she was a superstar. She's always been a superstar, and you guys are going to forget about me today, but you're going to remember Shanita, and that's well and as it should be. And so congratulations again. I came to be to tell you a little bit of my story and why I'm here today and what I feel passionate about. I was always good in math and computer science growing up as a kid, and went to work for Bell Labs out of college. And after being there for 3 years, kind of felt like I was making too much money and not really doing what I wanted to do. It was not engaging to my soul and my heart. So I looked around for what I really wanted to do then after a few years and tried my hand at math, liked that a lot, enjoyed the kind of wraparound 24/7, as Clark described it, of the experience and caring for kids, helping to nurture the development of young minds and hearts. And I really enjoyed doing that for 10 years. I worked in a kind of upper middle class school in central New Jersey, and that wasn't quite what I wanted to do either in education, so moved out to the Bay Area and met my wife, and we wanted to move to Oakland. And the small schools movement was happening then in Oakland, creating more personalized learning environments for young people. I was telling Ashanti earlier, I started off as an assistant principal at Castlemont and helped break the big school, large, impersonal, 1,700-student school with statistics very much like Mark was describing about McClyman's, where a lot of kids just fall through the cracks. It was a very impersonal learning environment. And we created four small schools on the Castlemont campus where I knew every one of my 400 kids in the school. I just wanted to get to know them, develop their relationships that are so important to us, as we know about. So rather than create dropout factories, which there are way too many of there in a big, impersonal, urban setting, and get to know the young people, let them know that we care about them, get to know what their challenges are. And for one of the important things here to me today to let you all know about is, rather than just hearing about the statistics and the overwhelming problems and the kind of rely on your myths or whatever you think about urban education and education of women, get to know people, get to know young people like Shanita, and they're incredible young people out there who are facing a lot of amazing challenges. Once you hear a little bit more about Shanita's story, you'll get to know that. But there's a myriad of challenges and stressors facing our young people today. And if each of us just kind of commits to putting our hands on one young woman out there, just to get to know somebody in a personal way, you can make a difference. And so that's kind of what brought me here and what continues to drive my work in education.
Melissa, how about you?
Thanks. I always get a little nervous speaking on these panels and feel like my story is just one of standing and watching God work rather than my really doing anything. I moved out here and started teaching at my school 5 years ago and just really fell in love with the students and with the community. And I think that our education system right now is a huge injustice, because where a child's born can determine the quality of education he or she gets. And that has huge implications on that student's life. But what we know to be truth is that every student is capable of doing amazing things. So I think the longer I stay in Richmond, the more I get connected to the community, and I love my the people in my life. This year, the students from my first year of teaching graduated high school, and it was amazing and wonderful and joyful, and also heartbreaking because not enough of them walked across the stage. And similar to a lot of what's been said, I think my passion is really in the relationships. Each year I get better at following more and more of my students through high school to make sure that all of them walk across that stage. So.
Excuse me. So I guess I'll start with education was my safe haven out of my home. I didn't really know I was smart until a middle school counselor, I was in eighth grade, came into foster care during my transition from eighth grade to high school. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me. I didn't know where I was going to live. I was being broken apart from my family, broken apart from my friends, from my neighborhood, everything I've ever known. And so I kind of knew, you know, I was teacher's pet. I really liked school because, like I said, it was home away from home. And so, but to this day, I remember my teacher, I'm sorry, my counselor, who we were, like Rick said, the small schools initiative was coming out. She came to me and said, Shanita, I really think you should go to a small school. And Councilmont was the only high school I had ever heard of. I lived in Oakland all my life, and my parents never talked to me about education. They never talked to me about higher education. They never said, I want you to go to this school so you can have opportunities. So I didn't know it was a such thing as college. I didn't know it was a such thing as graduating high school. My expectation was to, I don't know, go to high school. I don't know if I was going to make it or not and work at FedEx. Like, that was, like, the dream job because I always saw FedEx cars on my neighborhood. So I'm like, oh, I can work for FedEx, I guess. But my counselor came to me that day when I had to pick a small school, and she said, Shanita, I really think you should go to CBITS. And I'm like, what is CBITS? And she said, it's a small school at Castlemont. You know, I know some teachers there. And because you can go to college. You're college eligible. And I'm like, what is college? And she's like, higher education. So she started to explain to me. So it was then that my drive to be good, to be smart, started. And so when I got to CBITS, I was on this roll. I have to make straight A's. I have to go to college because college is going to save me. College is going to get me out of Oakland. College is going to give me an opportunity that, you know, my parents don't give me. And so my love for education really started there, because then I knew that it was going to give me a future. And so going through Castlemont through high school was a tough road. I could go on and on and on. But I was in foster care, lived across the street from the high school. They just built a house on the hill. And so everyone thought, oh, Shanita, you live in a nice house. You live right across the street from Castlemont. What don't you have? What's not wrong? Like, what's not good? What's not going good for you? But in the home, you know, it was chaos. I was still a parentified child, even in foster care. But I did my homework before I left school. You know, it was what I had. It was what I was good at. And then going to school, I had relationships with, you know, my principals. I had relationships with my teachers, relationships that built me up and that got me out of high school. Because during high school, I suffered with depression, anxiety. I was suicidal. My mom was dying of AIDS. Like, I had so many things going on with me. And my teachers and my principal really helped me work through it. There were times that I didn't come to school, and they heard Carla be getting on me, where are you, Shanita? You're not at school. Where are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm at home. I emancipated out of foster care. I had my own apartment. So some days I didn't want to go to school. I would go see my mother at the hospital. I would go home. And Mr. Gaston, my teachers would get on me, no, you need to come to school, finish out, do your senior project, you need to be here. But they knew and they were sensitive to what I was going through. So with all that said, they helped me get out of Castlemont. I got into Cal, and that was, you know, a culture shock. I was prepared for it with encouragement, but I didn't have a lot of educational foundational skills. Like, I didn't have rigorous study habits. At Castlemont, it was easy. You know, to me, it was easy. To other students, it was difficult. So when I got to Cal, what I thought was going to be another breeze turned out to be a shock. It turned out to be very depressing. I got here and I got here, and I had to learn how to learn. I don't even know what that means, but I had to always go the extra mile because I didn't have, like, my parents didn't read to me. I knew how to read, but, like, sometimes what I've learned in Cal is that when your parents read to you or your parents take you out to the park and they explain things to you, a child becomes better at common sense, putting things together, you know, making larger theories smaller and understandable, and I wasn't able to do that. And so before I did a reading, I had to read the summary first. Like, I had to look up definitions first. I had to spend 3 hours figuring out what I was about to read before I actually read it because I didn't understand it. And so through all of that, it was humbling, you know. I'm still blessed. I was so honored to be there. I didn't have to pay anything. You know, all my teachers and counselors said, no, Shanita, you won't have to pay for college. And so that wasn't a stress for me. It was just a matter of staying in and getting out.
Because she earned a full ride scholarship is what she needed, right?
Yeah. I earned 3, actually. and I gave one to Aaron, a student named Aaron, who also graduated from CBITS and went to Cal. It was just learning how, like I said, learning how to learn. And so all the while, my mother had passed 2 weeks after my high school graduation. I was actually right next door in this building in Summer Bridge. I used to park here all the time. and my second year of college, my siblings were going through some things. I have four siblings that were going through some things in their foster care home. I got custody of my siblings. They became my foster children. And I live in university housing here at Cal. And my Cal program, my mentoring program, real supportive. The student parent program is very supportive. And so I had to learn how to manage my schoolwork and also manage my family. I knew how to cook. I knew how to clean. I knew how to delegate. You know, I grew up knowing those things. It was just really buckling down, and now I was looking out for my brothers and sisters. And I actually watched them struggle the same way I struggled coming from Castlemont into Cal. They were coming from Oakland into nice schools in Albany, and they fell in the cracks. And it really didn't hit me until I saw my brothers and sisters struggling.
Cindy, I'm gonna stop you there.
I understand.
We're rich with stories, and we can go on for hours. And love all the stories. Ashanti, why don't you say a few words to get us rolling here, and maybe give a shout out to your two friends over here, your students.
Yeah, thank you for your story. I've been an educator for 11 years now. I'm born and raised in Oakland, California. Was raised by a single mother on welfare. My father died 3 months to the day before I was born. And my life has been a journey. And the journey of education is why I'm here today. I went to college with the vision of becoming rich. Like, that was my goal. I was like, I grew up poor. Now I want to experience the other side. And as I went to engineering and I went to work in corporate America, I realized that that's not what I was supposed to do. And I tried to ignore education. I was like, you all are people who told me I should be an educator. I told them, you're tripping. Educators don't make no money. And I got to make money. And I ignored it for 2 more years, and it just kept tapping on my shoulder. And I believe that God was sending me a message that I was trying to ignore. And when I became an educator in my credential classes at Mills College, there was no doubt that I was going to be an educator. Like, the stuff they were talking, the stuff they were teaching, there was no doubt that that was the work that I was supposed to be doing. My first year teaching at at San Lorenzo High School, I started a program called Ever Forward, which is a rites of passage, which is like, at the time it was a club trying to help some young men of color pass algebra. It wasn't even an organization. It was like, look, you're failing my class, and I didn't become a teacher to have you fail in my class. So I'm a bribe you. I'm going to buy you lunch once a week, and you're going to teach me how to be a better teacher because you're smart enough. So therefore, something I must be doing wrong. So it was really like a selfish decision. I was like, I can't have you fail in my class, man. You're too smart. So teach me. And it just turned into this program where young people came in every week, every Thursday. They knew exactly where to be, and they don't miss free lunch. And early on, they realized that the reason that they weren't successful was because it's not cool to be smart at that school. Like, it's cool to be a knucklehead, which is what I used to call them. It's cool to talk back to the teacher. It's cool to get kicked out of class. It's cool to, like, show how angry you can get and make a teacher afraid of you. And that didn't work so much with me, but it worked with some other people. But it was cool not to be the smart kid. And so we began to like learn strategies on, well, how can you be smart and not have everybody know about it, right? How can you do your homework at school and don't carry no books home, right? How do we figure out some strategies for you so that you don't not graduate when you're totally capable? And so 10 years later of this program that I've just been working really hard on, education was my ticket out. Like, I got the opportunity to live in Walnut Creek. Now, I live in Oakland now, but I lived in Walnut Creek. And I loved living in Walnut Creek. But I realized that I had some work to do in my backyard. I had some work to do in my front yard. I had some work to do in Oakland. And Juan is here and Roger is here, and I'm not going to tell a lot of story about them, but Juan, why is education important to you? Thank you. And Roger, why is education important to you? All right. And what are we going to do about that hat? Okay, because education never stops. Because education never stops. And
yes, this is being recorded.
Oh yeah, so Juan said, okay, sorry about that. I forgot about the recording thing. So Juan, you're gonna repeat what you said.
It's okay. So I think education is important because it opens the doors to many people, and for me, it's gonna be, give me greater opportunities when I join the criminal justice field. It's also gonna help me have a better life, so I can pass it on to my children.
Education is important to me because I like to learn, and I want to make my mom proud. It's my family.
And so that's really what's powerful. And so when I met Clark and we talked about this justice, power, oppression in women, it's really about, that's what education was about. It's about having a better opportunity in the justice system, being able to see past what oppression exists every day. Power, like there's a culture of power, and the less education you have, the less you have opportunity to participate in that culture of power. And the idea of women, our program, we started with young men, but we have a young women's circle also, and it's because my mom, she did the best she could with the resources that she didn't have, and I will forever be on the side of women who are struggling. We have so many women that are raising their children alone, and that's my work. And so I know there's been more questions, but I think that's start. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your introductions. I'm going to start with just, and then I'll step out of the way and we'll pass the mic and we'll get all the questions coming. But perhaps, so Shanita, your story was really amazingly compelling. And you described some of the challenges that you as a student face. And so perhaps we'll open that question up to some of the others. From your perspective, from the teaching role, what do you see as some of the challenges that students face in attending school?
I think one of the things that Shanita referred to that is too prevalent is there are parents having kids who aren't ready to be parents or who are not in their particular place in life, it's difficult for them to be a great advocate for their kids, and so aren't, you know, encouraging them to get out the door every day and have breakfast in them and talking to them about college. And you know, it's not to blame people in this whole conversation. I hope we don't blame anyone, but it's just like where they are in life right now. And it's hard for me to be a parent sometimes, and I have a wife, and geez, it's a hard thing to do. And when you have to work two or three jobs, like a lot of our parents in East Oakland are, and maybe you're on your own, and you have a few kids, and two of them have health issues, and you're trying to get them to doctor's point. I mean, it's overwhelming. And so just having that kind of foundation of support in the home is really a challenge and a lack for a lot of young people. And again, not because of a blaming situation, but just because there's often not enough support among the community or the organizations or the resources to help make that happen. And there's not enough support in the, like, Oakland Unified School District to help supplement that because of that poor education funding in California, especially in the last, 35 years.
So as an educator at Fremont High School in Oakland, on a daily basis, I think the challenges that a lot of our youth are facing coming to school is, first, they don't want to be there. The curriculum is not culturally relevant, which means you're teaching me stuff that, first of all, I don't care about. You're teaching me stuff that you haven't given me a reason why I should listen to you. Like, when we come into a place, and I think most of you came like you were interested in the topic, or maybe somebody bribed you with some lunch, or whatever reason you showed up, there was something in it for you. If I'm going to a place every day where nothing is in it for me, I see no value at the end of it, why do I show up? And if I know I have to show up so I don't go to get arrested, or so I don't have to go deal with the principal, then I'm just going to sit there until you give me a reason. And I think that most of our youth are dealing with a lot of trauma. We're dealing with a lot of youth whose parents grew up in a time where, you know, a lot of my students were born in the 90s. Their parents are children of the 80s, or the 70s. I have one student, he's 15. I talk to his mom on a regular basis. She doesn't know what to do with him. She's like, I don't know what to do with him. She had him when she was 15. What do you know at 15 about raising a young man, first of all? There's no father around. The father existed, but he wasn't around. So what happens? This young man's father is in and out of jail every 3 weeks. He knows this. And what does he care about? I don't care about nothing. I definitely don't care about what these teachers are saying because it ain't relevant. And so I think that the traumas that our youth are dealing with on a regular basis, when I meet youth, I'm really trying to find out what's your story. Like, what's going on with you? What's happening? And I had the luxury of that job this year, which doesn't really exist in Oakland. And it's not going to exist next year. Like, they experimented with it. It was having, you know, marginal success. But I think that what Oakland expects is that somehow they're going to put somebody in some position and you're going to fix all these kids. Like, you're going to create this magical development program that's going to magically fix years of trauma. And if for 15 years you've been dealing with trauma, there's not likely that in 10 months of school, somebody's going to all of a sudden fix you. And I always tell young people, I'm not here to fix you. I'm just here to learn from you. And hopefully you can learn something from me that you can take and apply to your life. And so I think that what our youth are dealing with in education is a lack of understanding by the people who make a lot of decisions about how we're going to make it better. We gotta plug in. It got to be a belly-to-belly thing, like, on how we're going to help these youth. And it's a hard work. It's not easy work. And so that's my answer on that question.
Melissa?
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of what Ashanti said, and I think we see a lot of that at my school as well. I guess, personally, one of the things I see that my students really struggle to overcome is just a sense of hopelessness. They start to buy into the lies that society has told them. And one of the hardest things for me to teach them isn't the academic content. It's the fact that if they work hard, they will get better, that they are capable of learning, because they buy into the lie that they're not, and that they're not worth it, that it's not worth it. And so I think one of the most important things we can do is come alongside them, stand with them, and just show them that they are worth it.
Thank you. So we'll open it up to questions. I can keep asking questions, but I know you all have questions as well. So just flag me down, and I'll make sure that we get a chance to hear from everybody that wants to speak. So over here. Okay.
So one thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately is a lot of more recent statistics kind of showing that a college education isn't worth what it was worth, you know, 30 years ago. And I'm also starting to see this problem that if you actually decompose it, that there seems to be a racial effect. That is, if you're looking at who's really being hurt by, say, the new, like, for-profit educations, the sort of new entrant, like, you know, University of Phoenix type things, who are the people that are going to end up gambling on not such a good post-secondary opportunity. It seems like it's the people that are having trouble being motivated and or coming from traditionally disadvantaged backgrounds in the first place. So I'm kind of curious whether and what you might have noticed along these lines. Are there other channels besides the sort of traditional college route that you can encourage students to really any reflections on sort of this growing problem where college might not have the same returns that it used to?
So I meet students a lot of times and I'm counseling them about what's going on. And unfortunately, a lot of them, I'm not able to counsel to a four-year college, and a lot of the students. So the idea is helping them to see, well, what is it that you want to do? Yeah, college, it's always interesting when I hear people say, well, don't worry about going to college because it's not what it is worth. Well, I know that if I didn't have a college degree, my options are much more limited in what I can do. I know that a college education is going to open some other doors. Even if I'm not going to be a civil engineer right now, I can go and do some other things that are connected. So I always tell people, young people, know if it's college is not for you, no problem. But don't let somebody tell you not to go because it's not what it was worth. Well, it's worth what you make it worth. Your likelihood, I mean, statistics say you'll make $1 million more with a college education than not. I know trying to help young people get a job at McDonald's that it's hard for them to get a job at McDonald's making whatever they make now. How do you survive on $9 an hour? Even if it was 12, even if it was 15, how do you pay for your own self, your rent, you're responsible with $15 an hour? That's still, it sounds like a lot, but it's a very little amount of money after they take 30% taxes out. So I think that the idea of having a career, a job, I think that is really based on the individual. I want young people to know that, hey, you can go into a trade. We got a port about to be built over here. They're going to need a lot of employees, but we need to get you ready now. Because when the jobs open up, if you don't have the skills, they're going to find somebody from, you know, Humboldt who's going to come down in here in their trailer and take those jobs. So you got to be ready. It's right in your backyard. Those jobs will pay you $30, $40 an hour, but you got to be ready. So I always want young people to know the options. If you want to go to a trade school, go to a trade school. If college is not your thing, okay, then what is your thing? But just know what's the consequences if you choose not to follow a route. Here's what you can do. Here's the jobs you can get. I think we just got to paint the picture for them. We got to paint the picture realistically because my mom never told me I was going to college. I was actually mad at her. I was watching the Brady Bunch one day when they were like, you're going to college. And Greg was fighting against his mom. Why are you making me go to college? And I went to my mom like, why you never told me I have to go to college? And she was like, are you going? I'm like, yeah. She said, well, I guess I have to tell you. And like, she tricked me, right? Whatever she did to trick me, she tricked me. But I think that we have to provide the options for our youth. And that's what happened to me.
Hi, I just want to say, first of all, I'm very happy to see you all here this morning. I'm an old lady now, but at 60, I can say that, for one thing, it's almost a little upsetting that I'm still hearing my story after all these years, because I was like a ghetto girl from Philly, whose, you know, my household was fairly a little bit brutal and chaotic, but the only thing that they emphasized was that I had to do well in school, you know, so I couldn't even get out and have friends and stuff. But I was good in school, and I had the option at the elementary school, because of the racial issues in this country, that I was actually bused to a middle class neighborhood, like in the early 60s when they were doing that. And so, you know, one thing that I would want to ask about is, what kind of emotional support do you have for, you know, young people of color that are moving into an educational level where people that they live with in their own community in the ghetto are not going to like them? You know, they're not going to have friends, really, in either culture. And I think that's really hard. You know, the issue of, if you get ill-educated, does it matter if nobody likes you? So how do you support them in that?
Well, I would say, me personally, I can agree. My family, they're at a distance. They're like, oh, okay, you know, you got educated. They didn't come too close when it was going on. But once I graduated, then they're all, hooray, congratulations. And I had to break away from friends. I had to come out of, you know, the lifestyle that I had when I was in Egypt in sin. And in college, the black community is not really big. And so I have the friends that I do have come from urban communities, one of which I grew up with her since like first grade. And so we really stuck close. But You know, and I made networks, but I wouldn't consider them friends. And having to, you know, when I got saved my second year of college, and so that also plays a role in having friends and having, you know, support my age, people who look like me and people who, you know, they're the same age as me. And so, yeah, it's hard because that was one of my other stressors. I'm a 20-year-old young woman taking care of four children. You know, I'm saved. I don't party anymore. I don't date. You know, like I cut a lot of things out. I'm here on college campus, but I can't be in certain communities because I have other responsibilities. And so I did struggle with that. And most of my friends are older than me.
I was going to speak on you actually, because I was going to say one of the great kind of things, you know, that happens in schools through, you know, amazing educators who go above and beyond and don't just teach math is that they form communities of students who support each other, because it's hard, you know, like with all the other things going on, the stressors and challenges, it's hard if you're solo, right? But if you have people, if you can make people around you, or you're in an educational community or a church group or something where there's a community who, you know, who are kind of encouraging each other, and that's at the heart of what Brother Ashanti does, I'm sure, is in his program, is to get a community of people who are starting to encourage each other, and it's a peer culture positive support group, and that's a big way to make it happen also. But it's not like institutionalized. It takes, you know, superstar teachers to come along and say, hey, I need to, you guys to teach me how to be a teacher. I mean, that's, you know, that's above and beyond. It's not part of what we do as educational institutions, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I was going to speak to that with EverForward, our young men's circles and our young women's circles is really about how do you create a support group around you that's going to help you when times are tough. So in our young men's circles, when we come together, it's really about, okay, just do a check-in. How are you doing? On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst and 10 being the best, where are you? And that's on a weekly basis. You have a space to go and hopefully let down the mask. And for young men, that's very hard. For young men who were raised with this idea of don't cry because it makes you look like a girl, they have a mask that's so thick that forces them to try and act tough even when they're feeling weak. And how do you help retrain our young men to recognize that tears are human? Tears are healing. But if you believe that tears make you weak, then you're going to fake how you feel to not look weak. And the worst thing you can do in a hood is look weak, because you become a target. You can become a victim. And so our young men, when they first come to us, they're just like, yeah, whatever. What's this? They're trying to figure it out. And I think when we help them transition to college, if they've been in our program long enough, they know that their job is to go and find some people who are like-minded, who they can go and figure out, who can I let down the mask with? Because when I'm really sad, angry, or frustrated, or whatever, I need to go to a safe place. I can't take it out on my teachers. I can't take it out on my people who are my relationships. And we have to teach them how to do that, and most of them don't know. So it's really helping them learn some emotional intelligence. Because I think a lot of our young men, they lack the emotional intelligence. You know, they have this toolbox, and all they got in there is a hammer. And if all you got is a hammer, you may be able to build something, but it's probably going to look pretty jacked up. If you ain't got no sandpaper, you ain't got no nails, you ain't got no file, you're just hammering everything, right? And I say, look, you got to learn some other tools, brother. That needed a sandpaper, and you hit the teacher with a hammer. Like, you just ruined that relationship, and all you need to do is wait till after class and ask a question, right? So it was really, how do we teach them how to do that? So when they get into college and now the professors are like, who are you? Are you a student here? Are you even in my class? Then you know how to be like, oh, of course I'm in your class. I sit on the second row every day. You don't remember me? I remember you. And how do you help them understand that those relationships are important? So I mean, I think it's really about teaching them some tools throughout that process of high school.
Suzanne, you're closer.
I'm concerned about how we nurture enough teachers to do what you're doing to make a difference on a large scale. It sounded to me like funding was iffy for what you're doing. Or do you do this on your own time? how can you nurture other teachers to do the same kind of thing and create more and more and more circles?
Yeah, as a teacher, when I first started the program, it was all out of my pocket. I mean, we didn't have any money. It was like I'm buying them pizza or, you know, having Chinese food brought in or whatever we were having. I think that it comes from the heart, right? And I think I pushed so hard that I wasn't really looking around for who was also interested in helping, because I don't have time. I think it was like I'm an engineer, right? I'm like, let's get it done. Like, let's do, right? I'm not a planner. I'm not a business major. I'm like planning it out. I'm like, I got some kids that are failing. I got to get into action. Here's a way I can work it right now. So I'm learning now, as you know, 10 years later, how to start asking for help. I didn't grow up learning how to ask for help. I learned grow up doing it. You need something to get done? Go do it, right? And so now that 10 years later, I'm like, oh, maybe I need to get some other teachers that I can create a mentoring training for them and start a program at those schools, because we need it. And it's in my own development as an adult man that I'm learning how to reach out and ask for help. And so I think that's a testament of me being here today. It's just been reaching out for help, and just like these connections begin to open up. So funding is always an issue. And so I've been funding it, right? But that's what I don't have any kids. I'm raising my godson right there, but that's what I do. This is my work. And now that I'm learning how to do the other side of it, it's just about reaching out to teachers who are ready to do something bigger, you know?
There are some educational programs, you know, in institutions that support the kind of program that Ashanti's talking about, and that Shanita benefited from one in our school called AVID, Advancement via Individual Determination, I think. And so there was a teacher who got a little extra stipend to do that, and then had a cadre of teachers around her that came together to support students like Shanita with some extracurriculars and some field trips and some after school stuff. But I think it takes to do things more at scale like that. It's going to take investment of monies. And, you know, people are all the time, you know, when you read about the politicians talking about, well, should we invest more in schools? Well, it takes resources. You can't do these things without resources unless you're just relying on individuals to pony up. And that's not a way to really do things at scale. Next time you hear a politician talk about, is it worth investing in our schools? Well, look at where their kids are going to school and what their class sizes are. And the teachers are, you know, got 15-1 in their classes instead of 35 like there are in Oakland. And there's a lot of things that money can do in schools, like provide those extra programs to come up around in the extracurriculars and create the supportive environments that really benefit kids.
I agree. Funding is very important. In my experience, I haven't had trouble, praise the Lord, getting funding. What I've had trouble finding is people who have the time to invest in the students. And so, I mean, I think prayer is huge. The harvest is many, but the workers are few. Because money is great, but maybe just as an example, this summer I was given a grant to take students on one field trip a week. And so I've got all of the resources to do all this amazing thing, and my weekly struggle is finding someone who can come along to help chaperone. And I think what makes the biggest difference in a student's life is having that stable, loving adult there consistently for a long period of time. And so I think one of our greatest needs is people who can invest time in these students' lives.
And I can personally attest to that because, as an example, I'm sitting here once again with Mr. Gaston, and my science teacher, Josh, and my AVID teacher, history teacher, social studies teacher, Mrs. Sarah, they started with me at ninth grade, and they saw me up to my college graduation. And so they are still, Josh, I consider my godfather. He helped me with my brothers and sisters, came in over and built my furniture, you know, put an email out when I first got my siblings and had people donate money to me. These relationships, you know, sometimes it wasn't so much in the program itself, but it was in when the program was over, that those the genuineness of those relationships really kicked in.
I really appreciate the idea belly to belly that Ashanti mentioned, because I hear it in all of the stories is relationship, and especially I hear Melissa saying enduring relationship, and I hear in Sheeta the idea of likeness, similar background, similar age. I wondered if any of you can latch on to some people who don't have a lot of time, but occasionally have time, or something that's more specific to what this community might do. You know, is it a long, maybe not long term, or does it need to be long term? Have you had experiences where, you know, what are your experiences of kind of people coming from outside in to help that have been most helpful?
Yeah, I was going to encourage everybody here to, you know, become a mentor. If you're looking for, well, I don't know what to do about all this, become a mentor. Talk to any of us, and we'll hook you up with somebody to mentor, you know, by this fall. There's a big need. You know, it can be chaperoning field trips. It can be just the meeting with your young person once a week, helping them, which is going to look like tutoring. It's going to look like listening to them, especially listening to them. Giving them that unconditional support. It doesn't mean you're going to fix them. Don't go in trying to fix them. Don't go in like with, you know, superior kind of attitude or anything, but just somebody to be there and over the long haul. Because they're, you know, unfortunately, with the challenges that there are being in Oakland educators, a lot of turnover. So these young people, by the time they get to high school, are, you know, they've had a lot of people come in fall and say, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and then that teacher disappears by next year, or. There's just a lot of turnover, unfortunately, and so somebody to be there consistently, you know, like Melissa's saying, really, really helps. And yeah, so just get that relationship over time is going to really help out if you're looking for something to do.
Yeah.
Did I get to what
you're speaking on? Okay, so a couple more questions. We'll start with Kathy, and then come to you, Mark.
Hi, I was, among many things, I really resonated with, Ashanti, your comment that you really need kids, you need to give kids a reason for why they're learning what they're learning, or the way you said it is, it's just not relevant to their world or relevant to anything they think they're going to need or do. So could you elaborate a little bit on that, and maybe others of you too? What would you change? Would you just broaden? What would you change if you were king for the day? How would you evolve the programs or our system so that it is relevant, and so that when the kids actually do show up, they have a reason for sitting there and learning?
When I visited classrooms before, I would talk to teachers, and they said, I'm having a hard time with this class. They don't listen. They don't pay attention. And I have a presence, I think, when I walk in, because they're like, first of all, who's a stranger? And so I just say, so what are you all interested in? And I think they start listing out all of these things that they're interested in. I'm interested in bikes, I'm interested in skateboards, I'm interested in this, I'm interested in that. And how incredible would it be to have a curriculum that was created based on their interests, right? If I'm a math teacher, you know, I have a curriculum I have to get through. But when we do projects, I want them to research, investigate the math that's included in those projects. Like if you're interested in skateboards, okay, why would one skateboard cost $200 and one cost $12? Well, what's the difference? Well, maybe you gotta have to do some investigation about what math is involved in creating a $200 skateboard as opposed to a $12 skateboard, right? And so if now you're interested in it, you're gonna be invested. And we all can't do that with a curriculum, right? Curriculum is tough, right? But it requires our interest in what they're interested in. For me, the first day of class, their homework assignment is write me a letter. And it's in that letter is about what things are you interested in? What things are you good at? What things do you struggle with? So that I can begin to get a feel. So when I'm like having a conversation with you and I really want to get on your case, I'm going to be like, have you been skateboarding lately? Oh, good. Now let me ask you a question about this homework assignment that you didn't do, right? Like I need to be able to have a buy-in point so that they know that you care about them. And I do. But sometimes I'm focused on the work. Where's your homework assignment? Where's your homework? Right? Now, if I've built enough money in the bank with them, they know that I care and that I'm going to get on them anyway. But if I just start in with, where's your homework? I'm like, first of all, who are you? Just because your name is on the door don't mean I got to like you, right? And it's really like making those connections. And I think that's what makes it also culturally relevant, is that if you not only feel sorry for them, but you understand where they come from, I mean, you understand that there's ways of helping them to accept who they are without feeling sorry for themselves. And that's I think that's how it happens in terms of the curriculum. In my classroom is why how it happened.
I think that, yes, I agree with everything that you said. Another thing that I've found is that kids want to learn. They want to do this. And when you you can invest them by showing them that they're getting better. I work with a scripted curriculum in my Read 180 class. And so there are... There's not too much leeway on tying in a lot of different aspects because we're following a script. But the kids are able to see each week their reading level improve a little bit, and the buy-in is huge because they realize, hey, I'm learning, I'm getting better, and all of a sudden it is relevant to them because they can do it. The problem is when we give them curriculum that has nothing to do with their lives and we don't give them any reason to work hard at it, to care about it. So it's a combination of teaching them about their lives and about why it's important, but also that they can do it because they want to learn. And so if you give them the tools to get better, it's not hard to get them motivated.
And to end that, come in with let them know that they're already smart, because I think most low-income, at-risk youth have the idea they're hopeless. They're thinking, I don't know this stuff. I have this teacher yapping at me, and I already feel inferior. They already have an inferiority complex as I'm coming in stupid. I don't know. You know, they get no encouragement from home or anywhere else, and so they already have this mindset, this defeated mindset that I don't know. And so on top of all those other issues of not having a relationship, not knowing how to bring it to their level, they have this defeated mindset. And so with some encouragement, hey, you are smart, but I'm teaching you this. I'm adding on to what you already know.
Ashanti, I had a sort of a follow-up question on a lot of the stuff we've already talked about, but it's just around mentoring, and you're obviously a teacher mentor, and we talked about the huge trauma that's in most of these kids' lives, and the need is massive. So I'm just wondering, though, about the connection in, say, your after-school programs. The need is huge. Does that mean there's a line out the door to get into your programs, or is there, how do you make the connection to draw them in to mentors, whether it's you or me coming in after school? And then just a second over, just general question for everybody, is just, do you feel free to talk about faith and God and talk about the divine image and the kids that you're working with, whether it's public or private schools, whatever.
Yeah. I wish the door was being beaten down. I think one of the challenges definitely I experienced at Fremont is that, when we do our first meeting, I believe in like being totally transparent and with the students, is that we're going to expect you to go deep. Fremont just has a young men's circle right now. We're expecting you to go deep. And for most of them, they don't know what that means, right? Oh, I'm deep. But so our first question when we're in the circle is, they have to complete a sentence. So they say, if you really knew me, you would know whatever, right? We used to say, you can't tell by looking at me that. So one of those kind of formations of that kind of question. And so it's up to you to pick up whatever, to come in at whatever level you want to tell us. My favorite color is purple. I have a dog. I live two blocks from here. Or something deep, like my father died before I was born. Oh, wow. Okay. He dropped a bomb on us, right? And for young men, when they're in the circle, after the first round, it's usually pretty basic. Oh, I like the Lakers or whatever. And I'll say, you know, so we're going to do another round, you know? And I'll say, ideally, I want somebody else to start, because I always start the first one and I keep it pretty basic. And I want somebody else to start. I said, but I'm really asking you to go a little deeper. And really what I've experienced in that role of a mentor is that I let them get in how they fit in. But it just takes one of them to drop it. And then all of a sudden, they start to really start feeling uncomfortable, right? Because they're uncomfortable when people start getting real. Like when you get real, real, right? Not like real, like I'm talking some jive, hangout, slang talk. I'm talking about like my mother is in jail. I haven't seen her in 6 years. Oh, well, I can't just, it's hard for me to next after that say, oh, my favorite color is purple. Now I could, and some of them will, but it's harder for them to. They're like, I think I'm a pass, right? And it's really for me opening that door. And when some of them that first meeting, we've had young men cry that first meeting, and not come back. Like they got scared. They thought we tricked them. They're like, you tricked me. You did something to me in that room. Well, no, we just provided the space for you to let down the mask so you can be totally connected to who you are. And I think that if they are allowed to do that regularly, that's a young man who left. It took me another year to get him back. He finally came back. But he knew he was missing it. Every time I would see him, I knew, because he had a lot of stuff he was carrying, but they carry it rather than having a place to release it. And so I'm comfortable letting my students know that I'm a Christian. I am careful in our education setting to push my values, but my values are based on what my beliefs are. No, you shouldn't be smoking weed. No, you shouldn't be drinking. But I'm not going to sit here and be like, why are you drinking weed? Why are you drinking? Because I'm shutting the door, and they won't come back. And so I need to be like totally like creating a space so they know that, well, this is how I operate. But so tell me, why are you doing it? Non-judgmental, because I'm not there to be their judge. I'm there to be a person who they can trust, and I can infuse my little bit of wisdom of how it's worked for my life and how it's not worked for other people's life who've tried it. So that's my experience around that.
Yeah, I appreciate that question because, you know, working in public schools, at least, you know, you're not going to come out and just preach in class. But I think with all of us up here, clearly it undergirds the work, you know, our faith. And it's important to me, you know, working in education, especially in our area where there's such immense need and such a shortfall of quick fixes, and you know, you have to feel so humble about your ability to really affect change and make a difference. You know, it's only God that's going to fill that gap at some point, and you just have to, you know, kind of do the best you can do in your day, and then be able to take care of yourself a little bit at night and let go and let God. And that's very difficult also. There's a lot of, you know, you go to bed heartbroken a lot of times at night, just seeing what kids are struggling with out there. And so, you know, the only response you can have at some point is to pray.
And I'm blessed first and foremost with the opportunity to have no boundaries in ministry, to go out to the streets on a bullhorn, most likely every Sunday, and preach the gospel with no, you know, police drive by, crazy ladies on a bullhorn, and so I have, you know, I have the space and the opportunity to do that. But when, you know, when I'm at my job, or when I'm somewhere that, you know, it's not permitted, is, you know, you have to be careful. You have to be wise as a serpent, harmless as a dove. I use those opportunities, and they, you know, hey, Shanita, what do you do? Who are you? Because they're like, why doesn't she cuss? Why doesn't she do this when I refer to that? And so when I have those sneaky preachy moments, as they say at my church, that's when I come in. Hey, you know, I used to do that, but this is what changed me. You know, this is he is Christ. And then they're like, oh, wow, I just had the opportunity to do that yesterday. My brother's fourth grade teacher invited me. She mentors a previous Castlemont student who I graduated with. And she has a 3-year-old child now. And she asked me, she's like, well, Shanita, can you give her any pointers? Like, encourage her. And I'm like, well, hey, we all walk differently. but how can I help you? I didn't want to come off, girl, I'm saved, get saved. That's it, and that's all, stop it. In the inside, it's like, I want to say that. But I said, well, what do you have, what do you want to ask me? And when she asked that question, hey, my baby's father and such and such and such in the toxic relationships. And that's when I came in and I said, hey, you know, I came from that. I come from the toxic relationships. But my sophomore year in college, Christ found me, you know, and this is who I am. I'm not the Shanita, oh, she did it by herself. She take care of her kids. No, that's not me. That's him in me. And so when I have those moments that will slip away like that, I use those.
I love that question because it's been kind of remarkable what God's enabled me to do, which I don't stop and think about nearly often enough. But my after-school club is a Christian club, and we meet in my classroom, and we pray together, have our check-ins where we say, you're high and you're low of the week, and we go on field trips. And actually, in another week, I'm taking 15 of students in my class to camp for a week where they're going to hear the gospel and also get to do all sorts of fun campy activities. and that's all God. I didn't have any role in that other than being there. And then the other thing I'm just very aware of is that my life is transparent. The kids see me walking to and from school, and they see how I live and how I treat them and the choices that I make. And so it's just so important to be in prayer constantly for them and to just see God move and work and come alongside that.
Wow, what a conversation this has been. And we're at 11 o'clock, time flies. So, first of all, would like to thank the four of you for your thank you for your lives and your witness and what you do. There's nothing more important. So, for close, I'm going to ask Randy to close us with a quick prayer and.
Thank you, and thank you, everyone. I do have something here that's prayerful, okay, to conclude with. And I just want to, again, this business of relationship is so huge. And extended families, Psalm 68, that God is a father to the fatherless. He is a defender of the widow, and he sets the lonely in families. I mean, we have an opportunity as a congregation in so many different ways. And I started out talking about McClyman's High School, and the graduating class was 37, okay, out of the 70 students. But also this summer, there are 9 students able to take summer internships, be employed around the Bridge Project, and also manufacturing. I'm very excited about that, but you know why that's happening? Because there are believers, people of faith, who are leveraging resources for students and complementing what our teachers are so wonderfully doing in our schools. There are so many opportunities, and our superintendent, at least in Oakland, previous superintendent, not Gary Yee, now Gary Yee, full-service community schools. It does take a village to educate our children. I'm going to read this prayerfully. It's touched me so greatly. It's called Step Along the Way, by Archbishop Oscar Romero from San Salvador, who was assassinated March 24th, 1980. It helps now and then to step back and take a long view. The kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it's even beyond our vision. We accomplish in our lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete, which is a way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. This is what we are about. We plant seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces far beyond our capabilities. We cannot do everything, and there is a sense of liberation in realizing that. This enables us to do something, and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it is a beginning, a step along the way, an opportunity for the Lord's grace to enter and do the rest. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders, ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. Amen.